Okay, you're welcome back to the programme, and we're going to be talking wills now and the importance of making a will or planning ahead, and we have in studio to help us with this, and she's just sat down and I'm putting her straight to work, Geraldine Coughlan, President of the Inish Own Bar Association. Thanks so much for your time, thanks for calling in.
Thank you for having me in.
I'll start with the old chestnut, and I think some of us bury our heads in the sand because we don't want to make a will because it's too morbid and it talks of death and our demise and stuff. Are we getting better at realising that this is just good planning?
Yeah, that's the mistake a lot of people make. They equate wills with dying, and that's not really... Once you own property, you're married, you have children... All of those life events that happen, you should be thinking of changing your will and making, you know, and if you don't have a will, making a will first and having a will. It can be too late if you leave it. And that, you know, I've been 40 years in practice and often that happens. I go and see somebody, they're very old and elderly, they know what they want, but if they can't communicate it, that's a difficulty. They have to have the capacity.
Yeah. And do the majority of us make wills?
It has changed. Most, you know, as I've been in practice, I see more and more young people when they get married, people that maybe have a child and aren't married, or they're in a relationship where you don't have automatic succession. But most people are tempted to put off leaving a will for another time, think of the future. But life is unpredictable. You never know what's going to happen. And it's never too early to plan ahead.
Well, I suppose let's just start off at the beginning. What's a will? What is a will?
A will is a legal document that outlines how a person's property, money and other assets, it's also known as your estate, should be distributed after their death. This usually involves leaving your assets to family, friends or a charity that is important to you. By making a will, you can ensure that your estate is handled according to your wishes.
Now, does the will always have to follow your wishes? So say, for instance, there would be someone, I don't know the ins and outs of it, but say you had a partner, right, and or a wife or a husband, and if you didn't have a will, automatically I presume stuff goes to them and whatever way it might be. Does the will trump all of that? So you can decide whatever you want to do with your estate?
Absolutely. That's the point of making a will, because there are laws if you don't make a will. The law dictates who gets it, and often it's not who you want to get it. And they are often vulnerable people. You could be in a partnership. People refer to living together as partnerships, but they're not partnerships. It is no legal recognition. Now, they are, you can make a claim as a cohabitant, but it's not always successful. So the only time we had civil partners was a very brief period before we brought in marriage between same-sex couples. So people refer to somebody, oh, this is my partner, and they can get confused that they have some rights.
Right, so theoretically, you could say you were married and you separated and you took up with somebody else and lived with them for 15 years and then you died. Theoretically, the person that to whom you were married to might have more entitlements than the person that you spent the last 10 or 15 years living as partners would have.
Absolutely. That is very, very common. Somebody is living with somebody and unexpectedly they die. They haven't made a will and they're not legally divorced. So you're still married even if you're separated. The wife takes precedence and is the beneficiary. Now, there are laws about cohabitation where you can make a claim if you're economically
dependent. Proving that as well I've lived here for 10 years. Well, I can't take your word for it because there's someone else saying that you didn't. So you have to go through all that rigmarole potentially. So that is one scenario, but I think that's more common now than it would have been in the past. I think people are, relationships are breaking up more, new relationships form, blended families and all that type of stuff. We are seeing more of that now than we might have at the beginning of your career.
That's correct. But it would have been more difficult in the past. For example, homosexuality, couples could not get married.
Yeah.
So that was very difficult. But now that has been solved. So there is marriage. Other things like that that have changed. Children can make a claim and spouses can make a claim, and cohabitants can make a claim. But things have changed in that people are more educated and by things like this where people come in and promote making wills. But if you don't make a will, you can't guarantee the people you wish to provide for will be provided for.
Yeah, and what you might leave behind you, because there are situations where it becomes even more complicated. Say there was a family farm or something, or, you know, in my head, I'm thinking you have to think of your own situation, you know, a house or a car. But for others, it could be much more complicated, and a will makes that much more clearer. How daunting a task is making a will? How should we see it? Is it a simple process? Is it a big deal? It's a big deal in terms of what it achieves, right? But is it a tough process to go through?
No, it's a very, very simple process, but I would recommend that you use a solicitor. People nowadays go online and you can take down an online will, and that is the worst you can do. Making no will is better than having a will that is unclear, not valid. So if you just making a will is not a daunting task, but it's important that it's done properly.
Yeah, if you do it through your local solicitor or your community solicitor, then it's much less daunting, because as you say stuff, presumably they can say, well, this is the actual ramifications of that, or this is what that means.
That's what's important, because you can think, I've had people come in to me and say, I was over in the bank and the bank manager told me to make a will, so I want to deal with my money in the bank. But then you question this man, he's also got a farm, and, you know, it's much more complicated. So people can not realise that there's a lot of other aspects to look at, taxation. So it is very important to use your local solicitor, and every solicitor has experience in making wills.
So if someone comes into a solicitor, obviously the person has to be over 18 and able to make decisions. Who makes the determination of it's, I mean, sometimes it might be more obvious than not. Who makes the determination of the capacity of the person to make the will, to ensure that it's they that are doing it, it's their will? Their will is their will, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's very important. It is the solicitor straight away. You will know whether somebody, what you have to know is, what you have is the most important thing. Know what you have. Also, know who you should benefit. Now, you may not necessarily want to benefit them, but it's important to know that somebody has children and why aren't they providing for them. And the other thing is that you are rational. Now, if there's any difficulty in relation to that, most solicitors would get a doctor to examine them and say they're compos mentis. But it's a legal test, not a medical test. So it is the solicitor who will be able to assess the person when they come in. You ask questions, and very often you have to ask questions because people won't always give you the information. And when they come in first, you may say, oh yeah, this is what you need. Then you ask a few more questions and you say, no, that's not what you need. So it's important to discuss it with a solicitor.
Yeah, and it's important not to see it too as a one and done sort of a thing, like that you make your will at 35 or 45 or 19 and then that's it. Because we know in life, people's circumstances can change. Maybe they acquire property, maybe their business takes off, maybe, I don't know. So keeping your will up to date, I presume, is as important as making the will in the first instance.
It is, and that's but it is important to make that first will. You know, that's the one thing, make it a New Year's resolution. Because once you have a will, then it is easier to keep updating it. But when you make a will today, fast forward, things change. As you say, you get married. If you've made a will and you get married, that cancels the will. If you made a will when you're married and you get divorced, it doesn't cancel the will. So these are the kind of things you've got to be careful about. So you have to keep changing it as your circumstances change. If a child is born, those are the kind of things. Keep up to date with what's happened.
In terms of the cost, is there a ballpark cost? Let's just not like talking about costs,
yeah, this
right?
Was a question.
But I mean, you know, like, is there a range?
There is a range, but the one thing I have to tell everybody who's listening is that the Law Society obliges solicitors to tell you the price up front. We have to tell you how much it is. So you can pick up your telephone, ring all the solicitors in your locality and say, I want to make a will. They'll ask you some questions. Do you have young children? It's going to be much more expensive if you want to set up a trust. are you married? Do you want to do reciprocal? That's quite, you know, common. I leave everything to my husband. He leaves everything to me. Then we both make the same provisions for our children.
It's based on how much work there is in putting the will together.
Exactly.
It's like every other industry.
So there's no point if I sit here and say, oh, you can get a simple will done for, and I give you a figure, then everybody rushes in.
Yeah, but you see, the thing too is there's this irony in that, you know, people might say, oh, right, if I donate to charity, they'll do me a will up, or I can download a form. To avoid costs. The costs come with the complexity of the will, so it's counterintuitive, isn't it, really?
It is.
As I think you said a little earlier on, but almost as better off not doing one. Who has a right to view a will? My ex-husband died suddenly and no one would let me see if our children had been left anything. He owns property and land in his own name after our divorce. So does a divorced spouse... former partner who, you know, through divorce, do they have a right to see a will, or who's entitled?
The only person entitled to see a will is the executor, the person you appoint.
So who's the executor?
The executor is the person you appoint to carry out your wishes. When you make a will, one of the key things is you appoint the executor. That is the person who will get your will, read it and carry out your wishes, do all the work involved.
That can be anyone. They're not a professional as such.
Yeah, and it's... Sometimes people think, oh, my executor must be somebody who's not getting something, because that's a witness cannot witness. Somebody getting something from your will cannot be a witness. But the executor is it's always better to have an executor who's getting something in your will.
So if I hypothesise with that last caller, if you don't mind, say the executor of the will is the ex-husband's current partner. And, you know, in his will, he had left something to his former wife. There's no safeguard there, is there, to ensure that what he may have bequeathed to the former wife, she gets something, because the executors might be in their interest to not make that known.
There is a great safeguard, and the wills are proven in the High Court and become public documents. That's called probate. Mm-hmm. When you prove the will, it's a grant of probate. Anybody can go on to the court's website, courts.ie, if you know the name of the person and the date they died, you can put them in, and when the will comes out, anybody can get it.
Okay.
So it becomes ultimately a public document. But while it's been proved, only the executor can look at it. I mean, I could leave you €1 million because I think you're great.
You.
And then I die and I've only got £10. So that's why until a will is proven and all the assets are taken in, nobody, you know, it's...
But eventually that person will get access to that document.
Eventually and very simply, and anybody can do it, courts.ie.
Right, OK. Let me see, what other questions did I want to ask you? We talked about keeping the will up to date, didn't we? This is kind of separate, I think. Are prenuptial agreements enforceable in Ireland? They're dodgy everywhere,
They're dodgy everywhere, depending on, you know, the vulnerability of one party. It's just the law of contract generally. Yes. If somebody is in a more vulnerable position, then you may be able to say that you didn't give it of your own free will. But the courts do take them in if it's a second marriage.
Yeah.
Quite often people will do an agreement, and I have done them, if two people have separate families, they're getting married, I give them the warning they may not necessarily be watertight. But the courts will look at that because they are, if they each are of equal standing, they're both fairly well off and they both have separate children, but it's still not legal, as in you can be guaranteed.
Back to the wills, if you don't mind, because we do talk, say, for instance, there'd be special drives and encouragement for farming families to have wills, you know, the owners of farms and stuff. But in terms of that, you know, if you have a farm or maybe you have a business, right? I think what puts people off making the will is you start having to have conversations whilst people are alive. You know, well, I want this to go to my second born son, actually, because he's always taken more of an interest. And then the older daughter goes, well, Alan, what about me? Does that discourage people, you know, when farms and businesses are involved? They sort of say, right, you know what, you can sort it out when I'm gone.
Well, I would think that would be a very bad idea.
Oh, I agree with you.
Yeah, and I think when you go into your solicitor, it's totally and utterly confidential. And you get a chance to make those decisions rather than leave it. And the business you worked hard for all your life, if you don't make provision for succession for somebody who can actually manage the business, your business could fall apart if the family are fighting over it. If you don't make a will, everybody can claim, you know, I mean, your children.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a good idea. Generally, as I say, in a solicitor's office, it's very private. If you go to these drives, they're very good as well in getting information. But most people who go to those promotions will then make an appointment with their own solicitor.
Yeah, I think that's more to
so
get
they
people
are, they are very, very
engaged.
Good. Yeah.
My mum's will was made about 30 years ago when I was very young. She's deceased about 20 years now, and to this day, I've no idea what is in her will. The executor keeps putting me off. I am an only child. Why do I not have a right to see what is in it? That surely at this point would have gone through probate, wouldn't it?
It would if they did probate. It depends what's in, you know, was there an estate that had to be probated?
Uh-huh.
Maybe the property was in joint names and went to someone else.
Yeah.
So not always. If you have property in joint names, it automatically goes to the other party. So not property can pass outside a will.
Right. So what do you do? Hi, Greg. What do you do to look up a will from a few years back, say 3 years? So you talked about the public
courts,
availability of it. So
courts.ie.
Courts.ie, the name.
Yeah, just go in the probate, the mm-hmm. probate section, and the name and the date of death, and you should get it if it has been proved. If it hasn't been proved, you won't get it.
Right. Okay. So we've talked why you should make a will, how easy it is to make a will in most cases, updating your will, keeping it up to date. And we've also talked about, I think, or do we need to talk a little bit more about what happens if you don't make a will?
I think we haven't really covered that, because there's a Succession Act in Ireland, and it sets out all the degrees of
it's
relationship.
It's a blunt instrument, isn't it?
It is indeed, very blunt. So generally, the most simple thing is if there is a spouse or a civil partner and you have no children, the spouse or civil partner, now civil partnerships, you know, are gone. They're not, but there are still some civil partners who will benefit under a will. And they will get everything. But if you have children, they will only get 2/3 of your estate, and the remaining 1/3 will go to the children. This can be very difficult if the children are under 18 and you want to sell. Maybe the only asset in the estate is a house and you want to sell the house. Then you have to go to court and get permission to deal with the children's 1/3. So, and even dealing with banks or anything without a will, it can be difficult, because you might say, oh, I've only got, you know, one child, but another child could appear. And the banks are very, very reluctant to deal with property without a will. So you would then have to go to grant of administration. And that is, it's more onerous and more difficult.
It's a complication you don't want to. And it's important too for people to note, cohabiting couples and those in long-term relationships, even though as far as you're aware that, you know, you're Mr. and Mrs. or whatever combination, without a will, they have potentially no legal status.
No legal standing whatsoever, because I started off with husband and wife and children, but it continues on if, you know, and it's, you have neither, then maybe it goes to your parents, or then it goes to your siblings. And if you've nobody closer, it could go to all the nieces and nephews, some of whom you've never even met.
No.
Rather than, you know, the nephew or niece who's helping you out, the nephew who's helping you out working in the farm, could end, you know, who has given his time to help you, may end up not having any benefit whatsoever.
Right. And all of this is, the majority of it is alleviated with making a will. So
it
we learned where we
it
started.
It is indeed, because as I say, if you don't, it's based purely on blood, you know, next to kin.
Okay, brilliant stuff. And you can find your local solicitor. There is a tool there, actually. What is it? Find a solicitor.
Find a solicitor. Yeah, the Law Society website is excellent. And again, it's open to the public, like the courts.ie. You just lawsociety.ie.
And you say that you should get an estimate. Your lawyer, solicitor should give you an estimate.
Every solicitor is obliged to tell you how much it's going to cost, and everybody is more than willing, more than happy.
So ring up, and if you want to shop around, that's up to you.
You can shop around.
You're not going to get a surprise bill at the end of it.
All I would say is, if you haven't already, the best time to make a will is now.
Yeah.
Make it number one on your New Year's resolutions. And it is not expensive. While I'm not saying a price because of all the different things, it is one of the things that solicitors enjoy doing, and we like to make wills for people.
Okay. It'd be great if we had a central database for wills, wouldn't it?
It would. Now, we have changed the law on enduring power of attorneys, that there is a central, that is when somebody makes provision, well, if they become incapable to manage their own affairs, they can do an enduring power of attorney, but it has proved very complicated. So generally, though, most people will go to their local solicitor, and when somebody dies, we would send out a request to other solicitors, does anybody have that will?
Yeah.
So in a small community here, it's not that essential.
Yeah, but with people moving around and all.
Oh, yeah.
Making a will is one cost. Lastly, what happens when the person dies and the will is read? Is there a cost involved in that?
No, there's not. But we don't read wills anymore because of the way things have changed. The executor will come in and we will give them copies unless it's controversial and people request a reading. More often, the executor will contact his solicitor or his solicitor will contact him. He will come in and copies will be provided and he can give them to the beneficiaries.
Lovely stuff. Listen, Geraldine, it's been really informative. Thank you very much indeed. Sorry, just one last question. Could Geraldine advise about making a living trust as opposed to a will? We're here talking about wills. Are they very, very different things?
They are very, very different things. And you do need somebody with experience, because there's a lot of people think of trust as being really a good idea,
yeah,
but they don't realise that there's an annual tax, there's an income tax on trust. So you really would need to speak not only to your solicitor, but your accountant.
Yeah, okay.
If you're going that way.
We can't fleet through that. It's an important one. Okay, thanks so very much indeed. That's Geraldine Coughlin, who is president of the Inishowen Bar Association.
Here at Braden's House to Home Interiors, Moville and Bridgend, we stock recliner and fabric suites, dining tables and chairs, beds and mattresses, curtains and rugs, and don't forget our large flooring department stocking carpet, vinyl and laminate flooring. We can't be beaten on price or quality and give a weekly delivery service to Donegal, Derry and Strabane not to be matched. So call in today to Braden's House to Home Interiors, Moville or Bridgend for all your home furnishing needs.
Massive clearance at Evolve Clothing Letterkenny Retail Park. X-Hire suits from just €5 and €10. Yes, only €5 and €10. Don't miss out. Our biggest ever reduced to clear winter suit sale. Shop now and save big.
On Business Matters this week, I'll be finding out more about Inishowen marine engineering firm Seabound Engineering, which specialises in building aluminium boats. So join me, Chris Ashmore, for Business Matters on Sunday after the 6 o'clock news.
Business Matters on Highland Radio is brought to you by Local Enterprise Office Donegal. If you have an idea to start or grow your business within Donegal, contact the Local Enterprise Office to find out more about the supports available for businesses. See localenterprise.ie/Donegal.
Shekalaha Ama Highland Radio. Arna Dortugat ig Airgrid. Uproar agus forbor anga letrahas na hairn. Airgrid. Pobla guactu, era aguactu. Heshe.
It's 26 minutes past 11 and we're going to be speaking to Dr. Joe Kelly after a very short break. Okay, we are joined on the programme now by Dr. Joe Kelly. Imagine why. Dr. Joe, how are you keeping? I feel like I'm speaking to you from the main function room of Aris Nocturon with that background slightly blurred. It gives off
My brother would be pretty happy with that comment. I'm away from home at the moment. I'm in my brother's home here. But being a while, good hearing, good luck, good new year to yourself and to all listening in Highland Radio.
Right. As happens annually, state papers have been released. Why do we do this? Do you know, Joe? Why do we lock important public information away for three decades?
You before had Senator Shane Ross and later Minister for Transport Shane Ross on the radio. You did a brilliant interview with him some years ago. And I thought it was wonderful what he said. It's not the government, it isn't about what they tell you, it's what they don't tell you. And at the moment in this country, there's a lot of things that our government are not telling us. Now, social media and new platforms are allowing people to articulate things and raise questions. But a lot of the information that if society knew it at the moment would probably have people's backs up. Probably the present government wouldn't have been re-elected. You know, there's a management of information at all times. Now, some of that is necessary because it could be sensitive. And we're going to be looking at 1994. The English release it every 30 years, or sorry, 20 years. They've cut their papers, releasing of papers going back 20 years. We're 30 years. And I think 30 years is helpful for us because we're talking about Northern Ireland. We're talking about the Troubles. We're talking about very sensitive issues, the peace process. And information was made known to the public at that time, the talk that was going on behind the scenes, the work that was going on behind the scenes, it could have jeopardised the whole peace process. That's just one example. Mm. And that could be said in a lot of other types of negotiations, be it for the National Hospital, be it for road infrastructure, whatever's going on, there has to be a certain level of sensitivity.
But that being said, though, you see, my concern, Joe, and I can understand, you know, from security perspectives or even in political circumstance, you know, there is the art of diplomacy. But I would have concerns that maybe there are lessons and stuff we about contemporary scandals that we don't have access to, that we can't learn our lessons from, that we can't necessarily hold people to account, that might need to be held to account. And that's where it gets a little bit uncomfortable for me.
I agree with you on that. And where do you see the common good in all this? Like, what is the best thing to do? And, you know, again, I work as a historian and things look differently through the perspective of time than in the present understanding. And I've seen myself change my understanding of things over time. That comes with maturity and perspective. But when you're in the heat of things, maybe the clear mind isn't there. And so therefore, I don't know how they decide, but there are certain artifacts, documents that they don't release, even now after the 30 years. Some they feel are too sensitive still to release. And I am not sure what moral compass they use for that. But at the same time, I think there needs to be that kind of safety net. But again, where does it fall when you're trying to find truth and justice?
Yeah.
And when victims are out there that need justice as well, that aren't going to live forever. So yeah, there's questions there, and it's a very difficult area to be in.
All right.
I wouldn't have to make those judgments.
No. Well, 30 years on from 1994, scarily, what was the Ireland of 1994? Before we start talking about...
Remember that the government fell and one thought there were going to be a general election. But what we understand is the president of the time saying, I'm not going to dissolve the Dáil, but it didn't go to him. John Bruton managed to pull together a coalition government between Labour and the Democratic Left. And that was the Rainbow Coalition. So that was what was going on at the time in political circumstances. At the same time, from a Catholic Church point of view, they were really rocked with the Father Breton Smith case, the 17 allegations of child abuse with young boys and young girls. That really was, I think, the opening gate of the whole abuse scandal and the various reports that subsequently followed. And in the six counties, you had the great light of hope when the IRA declared a ceasefire in August of 1994. And then 2 months later, the Ulster Loyalist parliamentaries also said, look, we'll have a ceasefire as well. So that was the context of a lot of politics and our country politically. We had Riverdance and Rock and Roll Kids. I'm sure that rings a bell with many people. Michael Flatley. And then you had transition year was for the first time introduced nationally. As an option. So that was before my time. And in a world stage of the Rwanda conflict, the terrible massacre was there, and you had the Serbian war in Sarajevo, the famous attack on that. Nelson Mandela was made president of South Africa. So that was a great moment of hope in the world. Interestingly, Israel had signed a peace agreement with Palestine back in 1994, and to consider now where we are over 20 years later. O.J. Simpson, the famous snow
chaser. Was that in 94, was it? My word.
Yeah, 1994, yeah. He was jail or tried, sorry, for that at that time. And then the famous films, Forrest Gump and Pulp Fiction, and one of my favourites, Shawshank Redemption. And maybe people remember Whitney Houston, I Will Always Remember You, that song.
From The Bodyguard, wasn't it?
Yeah. So that was...
Well, it was a big year for movies and what have you.
Yeah.
Well, so let's get back then to what we learned. And we'll start with information that sort of predates 1994, but has come to the fore now, and in relation to Bloody Sunday and an inquiry into it.
Yeah, well, this would probably be of great interest to the listeners of Highland Radio and to ourselves, Greg, our own recent history. And what happened was that Tony Blair wanted an inquiry, a fresh inquiry, that the parents and families of the victims of Bloody Sunday wanted for a long time. And the Savile inquiry was ongoing to figure out what was the real truth behind Bloody Sunday. And Irish officials were astonished when they had invited the Anglo-Irish secretary in Belfast had invited the General Rupert Smith, who was a high senior army official in the British Army, a retired this time, seen this Savile report and the movement of it as a cynical political move designated to scapegoat the soldiers yet again. And as we know, 26 unarmed people were shot on Bloody Sunday, January 1972, 13 dying on the day. And he was more or less in agreement with Lord Widgery's report. That was a report that was done by the British government right away after the Bloody Sunday, more or less exonerating the British Army and saying that the IRA had guns and they were firing at them. No truth to any of this.
And his commentary that it was a cynical political move, was that directed towards the Blair government?
Yes, it was more that the politicians now were trying to hang the paratroopers for their actions. But look, we know from the Savile report that they were sent there to do a job and that they did the job, and that job was sanctioned by the British government. And Cameron later on had to come along, the Prime Minister of England, and apologise to the victim, the families and victims of Bloody Sunday. But, you know, this is where maybe when you release papers, for me that was a very emotional thing. I'll never forget that day when the apology was there. And I've said this to you before, God knows if I was in the six counties at that time, would I have joined the IRA because of what was happening there? You know, my back would have been got up, I would have been angry and annoyed, and I'd have been a young man full of energy and loss of direction. And here, so much hurt and so much terrible brutality happened as a result of what happened at that incident, Bloody Sunday.
And you know what you say there is quite interesting, because the infliction of and these acts have a consequence, and often they are some of the biggest recruitment drives. And I referenced earlier on what we're seeing in the United States at the moment, and ISIS and the radicalization of people, and a lot of that can be traced back. And there's no justification for it whatsoever. But a lot of that can be traced back to, you know, acts that was undertaken by the US government, and even the actions that are being taken by the Israelis at the moment, the genocidal actions in across Gaza. They've pretty much it flattened now at this point. You know, rather than fixing a problem in inverted commas, they are creating a much greater problem, in that how could you not find yourself being forced to take up some sort of it's a complicated one.
It's not even that, Greg, which I agree with in what you're saying, but it's then the cover-up of it. You know, if you deal with the truth then and say, look, as the Savile report found, you know, they lost control, the parachute regiment lost control, and had that been admitted at the time, I think there could have been healing and a less aggressive troubles in the north, and we to live with the legacy that. Anyway, that's the sad reality. And some of these documents I find are very, very difficult to read. Mm-hmm. Now, there's over 10,000 of them. So
we're only going to be able to fly through them, obviously. Yeah. Steak Knife is mentioned also. He's the IRA informer.
That traumatised the IRA Sinn Féin at the time. That's what they were being called. That what information was going to be released about some of the Sinn Féin elected representatives or other people, like that he was an informer. And Blair and Hearn at the time realised that, and they had to again be very sensitive about that, because they didn't want to have anything rattle the peace process that was very fragile. And again, that was it was tied into Donegal as well at a later stage. But that
that was a very interesting, just a comment that came across. But it was interesting as well that Tony Blair had asked Gerry Adams to amend a statement on the IRA.
Is this coming from the British papers now? Because this is early noughties,
yes.
Isn't there? Yeah.
So
do we know what he... this is the Gerry Adams statement on IRA disarmament. What did he want tweaked in there? Do we know? Is it referenced?
Gerry Adams obviously had to, and again, one has to understand where he was coming from. He had to try to bring the IRA with him and at the same time try to bring the political Sinn Féin, the whole movement peace process with him at the same time, and the nationalist Catholic population. So he was trying to ride two horses, which was a very, very difficult thing to do. And I think he did it very well. But he tried to put some of the blame back on the Irish government, on the British government in particular, he mentions, for not processing this quick enough, and that the IRA were quite willing to lay down the arms and move towards a peaceful resolution. And he made that very clear in his statement. But the Blair's government and Blair said, look, don't be trying to put this at our door. You're not going to split the Irish government and the English government. This is what we need from you, and this is what we suggest you should say in your statement, which was a slight tweaking of what Gerry Adams was saying, but it was more affirmative that the IRA would decommission. And again, they were probably thinking of trying to appease the unionists. That's what the governments were thinking about. But obviously, Gerry Adams had to take people with him as well. So again, it gives you a great insight into how the balancing of all this was happening.
Yeah.
And to say something else, that Piers Doherty, who's our TD in Donegal, like, he was involved in this at this time. He was very much part of these negotiations. And you see, reading back the years, some young pictures of him. And to think that there was somebody still in politics with that experience in our county. And again, that this ties into that whole period of history, which is very fragile.
Talk about the relationships and the diplomacy that's required too, and that's intergovernmental as well too, because there was some upset within Irish government ranks as it relates to Chris Patten and his role that he was given.
Yeah, Chris Patten, he was the former Hong Kong governor, and he was then appointed to the Independent Policing Commission of Northern Ireland, which was a central part of the peace process. You're talking about 1998. But the Irish government knew nothing about this appointment. They read it, one of the officials read it in the Daily Telegraph, the newspaper, and they were pretty annoyed with that. And Dermot Gallagher, who wrote to the Northern Ireland office saying, look, when were you going to tell us as the Irish government that you were appointing this man? And again, this was... simple things like that could derail the whole peace process and the trust between the two governments. While they were trying to get the trust of the IRA or Sinn Féin or the unionist politicians or the UVF, they also had to have a trust between themselves. And this was a very significant misuse of trust, if that would be the way to say it, that the Irish government weren't happy that they had learned this through the media. Mm-hmm. But having said that, what one of the documents that ties in with that was the loyalist leaders at the time, people might remember David Irvine and Billy Hutchinson. They were the Progressive Unionist Party and linked to the UVF or UDA, and Jerry McMichael and Davy Adams, they were in the Ulster Democratic Party. They were highly regarded. These were men that were involved at the political and also at the parliamentary level, trying to bring, much like Gerry Adams, and they were very, very, very well respected. And, we were fortunate at a time that we had people like Gerry Adams and these unionist politicians, men that had turned their way from the gun, so to speak, to get to more peaceful medium. And the government in Dublin and in America got more interested in these men and realised that they had a lot to offer. So again, at moments in history, give opportunities. A minute in history can give an opportunity that can become something wonderful. And we were fortunate that these men, even if we politically would have disagreed with them or in any way over the years, that they were happened to be there at the right moment, at the right time, to make this peace process that we're still working at work.
You talk about men and their role. Nuala O'Loan had an important role as police ombudsman for Northern Ireland, but wasn't as highly respected as she might have expected.
She's an amazing woman and a very articulate, competent, educated woman, a very rounded woman, a woman that I've had great respect for. And she was given the job, a very significant job, as part of the disbandment of the RUC and the PSNI being taken over, and there'd be more, a balance of politics and Catholic and Unionist and Protestant and Nationalist. The whole mix would be more healthy than the RUC is seen as being a British extension of control. And she was appointed and did a very good job, but she came under terrible lot of pressure and abuse, she said herself, from some of the unionist politicians. And she named one or two in particular in some of these documents that have been released. And so much so, one of the documents show that her son was badly beaten in 2006, and she put it down to being part of this against her and against what she was doing. And she was thinking of stepping down. Again, a very precarious thing that could have happened, would have totally maybe derailed the peace process, because she was also later involved with the OMA inquiry and the involvement of the police in that. And had they followed the instructions that the IRA had given, or whatever paramilitaries that had caused the bomb, you know, they had been phoned in advance. So she went and did those investigations, and she was thinking of stepping down. And she felt that because she was a Catholic and a woman, that these were the two things that were militating against her. Yet the big issue was the fact that they had to sort out a peace process, not that she was a Catholic and that she was a woman, but she felt that was the issue, which I thought was very interesting. Again, we're talking history and talking a time maybe where respect wasn't given to Catholics and to the fact that a woman would hold a very high position.
Interesting too, David Trimble, in the early noughties, he wanted a border poll. And it is, the reason I find it interesting is that maybe he perhaps could see the way the demographics in the north were going. And if there was going to be one, you know, in his time, well, the sooner you do it, the better.
Yes. Well, see, the part of the Good Friday Agreement, or the Belfast Agreement in 1998, that the British government would be obliged to call a referendum in Northern Ireland once there was evidence that there would be a majority in favour of unity. And obviously he knew the demographics, as you mentioned, and as leader of the UUP, he wanted in 2002 there to be a border poll on the same day as the Stormont elections for the Northern Ireland Assembly. And he wanted to call the Republican bluff, as he called it himself. And he said this would set it aside for another generation so they could kick it down the road. And what I found interesting in one of the documents, he described the Republic of Ireland as pathetic, sectarian, mono-ethnic and monocultural state. And so he wanted this referendum to take place immediately. But we know from Michael Collins, who later was the ambassador to the US, he was a government official at the time, that more or less Tony Blair, who was the Prime Minister of England, told Trimble, you know, to get lost, that this wasn't happening. And look, my own view personally is I don't think there should ever be a border poll. I think that King Charles needs to declare their intent to withdraw. We've said this before. And once the British declare that they're leaving and set a date like they did in Hong Kong, then we work towards it. A border poll, I feel, could be divisive. And as much as I want to see United Ireland, I want to see it in a way that is uniting. And we go back to
I'm not sure unionists might see it quite as such, though.
Is that, but that the point is, I think that would take a lot of the aggro and the vitriol that might be there out of it, and that they realise, look, demographically, you're going to be outvoted whether you realise it or not by a certain date. So we are getting out by that date. Now, you know what you just need to do? You just need to work together to find a solution.
That's one option.
That would put a pressure back on us now.
Just a quickie on Britain's Queen Elizabeth II. This was one of the ones that was making the headlines. She had a dim view of orange marches, and I did hear some trying to spin this to say she was actually talking about Catholic marches, not orange marches. But you're satisfied it was orange marches she wasn't too fond of.
Yeah. She more or less said that, you know, she was delighted to see that the silly season had gone by without any hassle. That didn't, obviously that was seen as a throwaway comment. It was an Irish official that was at a garden party with her, and it didn't go down too well. You know, some of the order, the Orange Order, and even the, recently their headman, the Reverend Mervyn, he had said that, look, it was a throwaway comment, and that she was always delighted that they marched in loyalty to the Crown every year on the 12th of July. So it's two perspectives on the issue, but it was a comment that she had made, and it was clear that she was probably more interested in the safety of both communities, and that it led to tension as opposed to maybe anything else. And I think maybe that's what she was trying to state. But it was just an interesting comment that she'd seen it as a silly season.
Yeah, OK. Ireland has faced allegations the end of last year, of anti-Semitism. And what these papers show, and it just shows really, you know, history repeats itself, or even the passage of 30 years, what does it change? But there were allegations of anti-Semitism leveled towards Ireland, but that's even predate these papers, goes back as far as the Second World War.
Well, again, papers weren't just necessarily released on the 30 years. Some of them were older, so some of them go back to 1944. And there's even ones older, going back to Bloody Sunday, off the first Bloody Sunday in Crow Park. So maybe we get a chance of that. But in 1944, see, Ireland was being accused of being anti-Semitic as a country. And one maybe forgets that De Valera went to the ambassador's house in Germany and when Hitler died here in Ireland and expressed his condolences. And that was seen as one of his greatest political faux pas or mistakes. But one has to understand at his time he was neutral, Ireland was neutral, and they had to be seen to be neutral, even though they were supporting the British by giving them weather reports that allowed them to land on D-Day. That was done by a Mayo woman that gave them in advance the weather, what the weather would be like. So he had to be seen to play, and this is the thing. You could see him at the time as being... So he was accused, there were Irish people who were being accused as being anti-Semitic. And in fairness, the Jewish people stood up, and this is over 80 years ago, and said that this was false, irresponsible and mischievous. And that the Jewish people in the country at the time spoke up. And one of the main people who was later mayor, Robert Briscoe, I think one of his sons would have been a TD as well. And he was a Jew. And he again spoke vehemently denying that Ireland was such. Now, what people maybe don't, and maybe this brings it in maybe to a more modern time, you know, Yitzhak Herzog was a rabbi in Ireland. He was the chief rabbi in Ireland from, I think it was about 1919 up until 1939, when he went to Israel. And when Israel was formed, the state was Israel, and then he became the chief rabbi of Israel. But he was known as a Sinn Féin rabbi, and he learned Irish, and he was a big fan of Micheál Collins, and he was a supporter of the First Dáil, and he also was a supporter of the War of Independence. And his son became the president of Israel, and then his grandson Isaac became president of Israel in 2021. Now, his son was born in Ireland, so the president of Israel's son was born in Ireland. His father was a fluent Irish speaker. He was known as a Sinn Féin rabbi. And to think maybe at the present context, Sinn Féin and Palestine and the anti-Palace, and yet here was a rabbi, and his son Isaac, who was the president of Israel, came to Ireland in numerous times because they realised their Irish roots. And in 2018, Simon Coveney talked about the personal connection between Ireland and Israel and how he spoke about the valuable contribution Jewish people had made and continue to make to Ireland. And to think, you know, that the diplomatic relationships aren't so good at the moment.
Okay, we don't have much time, but just a couple of other ones. President Yeltsin, I seem to remember the talk at the time, he was too drunk to get off the plane in Shannon.
That's right, and that was a big kind of cover-up, and or Albert Reynolds had arrived, but he never came off the plane, and some of the ministers. And look, the Irish government had to play a very diplomatic game and downplay it, but it would appear that he was just too drunk to come off the plane. And this was the time of, you know, communism was breaking up, the USSR was breaking up, and it was a very sensitive time again. But he was on his way to a conference in Seattle, and he didn't come off the plane, and the Irish... And ministers had to turn around and go back home and didn't meet the Russian prime minister. Yeah, that was very interesting, that one, yeah.
And JFK talked of some of the happiest days of his life in Ireland as well. Yes. What year was that?
Well, obviously he came here in 1963. In June, he came for 3 days. And his father subsequently, in some of the papers that were released that he'd been meeting an Irish diplomat, said was visibly moved by the warm welcome he'd received, and it was among his happiest days in his life. And interestingly, the respect that he had for the Irish Army, his wife, Jacqueline O'Neill Kennedy, who died in 1994, the year that we were talking about, she asked for the Irish Army to be flown out to do the cortege for him. The respect with which she had for the Irish Army, and she herself seen to it that this was done, which I thought was very interesting, to think that her army was so respected.
Yeah, and just lastly, you mentioned Bloody Sunday, the night in 1920. There is a story or information released in relation to that. Compensation, is it? Or
yes.
How would you phrase the payment?
Well, it was a lot of money. The reckon is worth the equivalent today, but nearly $500,000. It was a compensation of about £7,500 back then. And it was a Captain Patrick McCormick who was shot dead by Micheál Collins' gang on Bloody Sunday 1920 when he went out and shot 11 of the British intelligence officers, and his view is, you know, how does a mouse survive an attack from the cat? Will you take the eyes out of the cat? And that's what he basically did. And it was quite ruthless. People forget Irish freedom was paid for by a price of violence and murder. And he sent out his team, the Cario gang, to murder the British intelligence on the morning of Bloody Sunday, and which they did. And he was actually killed in the Gresham Hotel. It's in the film, actually, the Michael Collins film, him being shot dead on 21st November 1920. He was a nephew of the Bishop of Galway, believe it or not. So he would have been a Catholic, and he was an Irishman. He was from Mayo, and he had joined the RIC. But he was executed by shot dead by Paddy Moran, one of Collins's gang, who was later executed for it by the British Army. But the family were disgusted by his, you know, that they had claimed that he was an intelligent officer and that he'd been dishonourable to conduct against his country. And so the compensation had to be paid. And at the time, you've the peace negotiation, the Treaty of 1921-22 going on, and the British government wanted Ireland to pay half of it, the Irish government. And the Irish government, the papers were revealed in 1925, so this is an interesting one, that his execution was planned and that they had evidence that it was done in a very conscientious and with a purposeful means. So they were not going to pay half of this compensation. So the compensation had to be paid fully by the British government. So here's information coming out from 1921, even today.
Remarkable stuff. Dr. Joe Kelly, thank you so very much indeed. I really do appreciate you sharing that with us. Have a lovely day. The Bad Buffet to Dun Low Roads, very bad, I'm told, especially around Glenfinnan and Clohan. It is very dangerous. And also Loch Salt, I'm told, completely impassable. There are four cars currently stuck on the road there. A caller says, hi, Greg, I think the Queen might be in the Unionist bad books after calling the March in season silly. I'm sure she's too worried about it now, but I'll take your point. Micheál Martin and Simon Harris would do well to listen to this interview, Greg. It would learn them a thing or two about what the Irish people suffered at the hands of the English. And it is so true that if the people knew what the government are at behind closed doors, they wouldn't have voted for them. That's why people tried to educate themselves with other information other than the RTE news. But sadly, they don't. And here we are again with the same people in power. That's just one person's view. Thank you so much for keeping us nice and busy on our first show of 2025. It's great to be back with you. We didn't get to our competition. We ran out of time, so we've got five great giveaways tomorrow. If you called in, by the way, you're still in the hat there. So we do appreciate that. But that's where we have to leave it.